Only weeks before the embassy bombings, CIA briefers came to the White House to inform the National Security Council staff about intelligence reporting regarding al-Qaeda's efforts to acquire weapons of mass destruction. The briefer's assessment was that bin Laden and his colleagues were diligently working to create or purchase chemical and even nuclear weapons. What made this news riveting was evidence that the group might already be preparing an attack with the chemical agent VX, an extraordinarily lethal substance that could be used to kill hundreds of people or more. Proof of this came in the form of a clump of dirt, a soil sample collected near a chemical plant in Khartoum. It contained the chemical known as EMTA, which is produced near the completion of the process to synthesize VX. The Central Intelligence Agency concluded that there was no other reason, including accident, for this precursor to be present in the quantity demonstrated in the soil sample, except in connection with the production of this chemical weapon. Faced with the possibility of the use against Americans of one of the most deadly substances ever synthesized, the White House directed that planning begin for a cruise missile attack against al-Qaeda targets. Targeteers from the intelligence agencies and the Pentagon were ordered to draw up a list of potential targets for a U.S. military strike and made recommendations. Their roster of sites was forwarded to the Principals Committee, as the National Security Cabinet is known, for final selection. At least one target, a tannery in Khartoum owned by bin Laden, was struck from the list because there was no evidence of any activity involving weapons of mass destruction. A final group, six terrorist camps in Afghanistan and the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical plant, was selected. Within the small circle of officials who knew of the plans, some felt uneasy. Attorney General Janet Reno expressed concern about whether the strikes were proportional and met the requirements of self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, which is how the administration intended to justify them. Others were aware that a decision to attack another country is rarely made on the basis of clandestine intelligence, and the United States has not often pursued a strategy of preempting threats militarily. Yet the perception of imminent danger was powerful enough to overcome these concerns. At the principals' meeting, Sandy Berger asked, "What if we do not hit it, and then after an attack, nerve gas is released in the New York City subway? What will we say then?" Reno declined to vote one way or the other, but the rest recommended unanimously that Al-Shifa be destroyed. August 20th was chosen as the date because of intelligence reports that bin Laden and the senior leadership of Al-Qaeda would be meeting that day at the camp in Khoust. The target list was forwarded to the president, and Clinton approved the strike. For a brief moment, the operation appeared to be a qualified success. Al-Shifa was destroyed. Six terrorist camps were hit and about 60 people were killed, many of them Pakistani militants training for action in Kashmir. The Tomahawks missed bin Laden and the other senior al-Qaeda leaders by a couple of hours. This in itself was not a great surprise. No one involved had any illusions about the chances of hitting the target at the right time. The White House recognized that the strike would not stop any attacks that were in the pipeline, but it might forestall the initiation of new operations as the organization's leaders went to ground. The months that followed were a nightmare. The Washington Times, the Capitol's unabashed right-wing newspaper, which consistently has the best sources in the intelligence world and the least compunction about leaking, ran a story mentioning that bin Laden keeps in touch with the world via computers and satellite phones. Bin Laden stopped using the satellite phone instantly. The al-Qaeda leader was not eager to court the fate of Djoker Dudayev, the Chechen insurgent leader who was killed by a Russian air defense suppression missile that homed in on its target using his satellite phone signal. When bin Laden stopped using the phone and let aides of the calling, the United States lost its best chance to find him. From the first days after the August 20th strikes, Sandy Berger, Madeleine Albright, and several other principals recognized that there was no banking on a diplomatic solution involving the Taliban. The United States, they believed, had to be prepared to use force again, no matter how relentless the criticisms over Al-Shifa had been. The White House ordered Navy vessels armed with cruise missiles to remain on station in the Arabian Sea, ready to fire if credible intelligence arrived concerning bin Laden's whereabouts. The military did not like the mission, which disrupted scheduled cruises and training and left the ships out in the middle of nowhere, hovering in the basket, the area from which the missiles could reach their targets. When surface ships were briefly deployed there, Pakistani patrol boats motored out to meet them, relaying news of their presence to Islamabad, which likely passed it straight to the Taliban. For the remainder of the Clinton administration, Los Angeles-class attack submarines drew patrol duty off the Pakistani coast.